Brother John Knowles, speaking to the subject, the fifth trumpet and the first woe. And the reading for this evening's class, Revelation chapter 9.
Welcome, brothers and sisters, to our Revelation class. Tonight we'll be studying the fifth trumpet and the first woe. To commence this study then, we will open with prayer after we have sung together hymn number 140. The 140th hymn. Consideration is the fifth trumpet and the first woe. And as a basis for that, those who know Brother John, will ask Brother Frank Forster to come forward and read Revelation chapter 9.
Reading together from Revelation chapter 9. And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit. And he opened the bottomless pit, and there arose a smoke out of the pit, as the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit. And there came out of the smoke locusts upon the earth, and unto them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. But it was commanded them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only those men which have not the seal of God in their foreheads. And to them it was given that they should not kill them, but that they should be tormented 5 months, and their torment was as the torment of a scorpion when he striketh a man. And in those days shall men seek death, and shall not find it, and shall desire to die, and death shall flee from them. And the shapes of the locusts were like unto horses prepared unto battle, and on their heads were as it were crowns like gold, and their faces were as the faces of men. And they had hair as the hair of women, and their teeth were as the teeth of lions. And they had breastplates, as it were breastplates of iron. And the sound of their wings was as the sound of chariots of many horses running to battle. And they had tails like to scorpions. There were stings in their tails, and their power was to hurt men 5 months. And they had a king over them, which is the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in the Hebrew tongue is Abaddon, but in the Greek tongue hath his name Apollyon. One woe is past. Behold, there come two woes more hereafter. And the sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel, which had the trumpet, Loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour, and a day, and a month, and a year, for to slay the third part of men. And the number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000,000, and I heard the number of them. And thus I saw the horses in the vision, and them that sat on them, having breastplates of fire, and of jacinth, and brimstone. And the heads of the horses were as the heads of lions, and out of their mouths issued fire and smoke and brimstone. By these three was the third part of men killed, by the fire, and by the smoke, and by the brimstone which issued out of their mouths. For their power is in their mouths and in their tails, for their tails were like unto serpents, and had heads, and with them did they hurt. And the rest of the men which were not killed by these plagues, yet repented not of the works of their hands, they should not worship devils and idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and of wood, which neither can see nor hear nor walk. Neither repented they of their murders, nor of their sorceries, nor of their fornication, nor of their theft.
Thanks, Brother Frank. Reverend Hibbert with pens poised and minds ready. We look forward to our Brother John's comments.
Dear brethren and sisters, dear young people, well, it's been about 4 weeks since we had our last class, and I guess Revelation chapter 8 is a bit of a dim memory for most people, and inasmuch as we are involved now in a section which does have some historical details which are very important to our understanding of the vision, I think we'll do a very quick little bit of revision just so that we can see where we are. Let's take first the overall chart which you've seen several times. Now, this chart which we've entitled Unfolding Themes in the Apocalypse, it's very similar to the chart which is in volume 1 right at the beginning, and you will appreciate if I keep saying all these things for the people who can't see the screen. It's very similar to that chart, except it sets it out in just a slightly different format, whereas the chart in volume 1 sets it out with certain horizontal strips going across the page. On this particular chart, we've set it down in a vertical fashion. Now, we're looking at the section at the moment which goes from chapter 7, verse 9, through to chapter 15, verse 4. Now, that is the section which is written in black. Now, this, in fact, is the largest section in the Apocalypse. And I do want to keep repeating the structure of this because I do think some people may have difficulty in trying to work out why we have a vision, say, like chapter 10, which we're coming to soon, the vision of the rainbowed angel, and yet in Revelation chapter 14, what is apparently another very similar vision, dealing with the culminating judgments. Well, I've suggested in this chart that in chapter 7, verses 9 to 17, we've got the vision of the numberless multitude with the palms and with the white robes. And then we go on to chapters 8 and 9, where we deal with the seven trumpets, which are God's judgments on Catholic Rome. Catholic Rome being what we might style Universal Rome. Therefore, chapter 10 represents the culminating judgments on Catholic Rome. Now, because there are certain other things going on at the same time, which couldn't be justly represented under the vision of the trumpets, when we come to chapter 11, the next chapter, we therefore go back and we consider some contemporary events which are going on in the area of Western Europe, up in the area of France in particular. And so chapter 11, the vision of the two witnesses, presents to us some contemporary developments in the Western Empire. Chapters 12 and 13 present to us the dragon and the beast of the earth, which are contemporary developments in what we will style Christendom, which is not so much a political entity as a system. And therefore, chapter 14 is the culminating judgment on what we've styled Christendom. So you see, it's all really one vision. It's dealing with certain events that are going on at the same time. But rather than try and intrude these events on top of each other in order to maintain a strictly chronological order, the Spirit has seen fit to separate them chronologically and take them as themes. And therefore, when we come to chapter 11, we don't have to expect that the events of chapter 11 are after chapter 10, not at all. They are part of this overall vision going from chapter 7, verse 9, through to chapter 15, verse 4, and they represent several series of parallel events which are taking place naturally at the same time. Well, we've come down in the course of our considerations to look at chapters 8 and 9, which consist of what are styled the vision of the seven trumpets. The next transparency which we're going to put up is the transparency which you will find in your notes, the fold-out sheet in volume 3, which presents to us the seven trumpets. Now, in our last class, we had a look at the first four of those trumpets, which Brother Thomas styles the four wind trumpets. Answering to the four winds which were restrained back in the previous chapter, in chapter 7, those four winds, representing four aspects of judgment, are now poured out upon the Roman earth, and they answer to the first four trumpets, styled, as I said by Brother Thomas, the four wind trumpets. Now, you can see from the writing of your notes, even if you can't read all that little print up there on the transparency, that deals with a series of events, the first trumpet dealing with the year AD 395, when there was hail and fire mingled with blood, answering to the work of the Huns and the Goths as they invaded the western section of the Roman Empire. The second trumpet brings us on to AD 429, a great mountain which was cast into the sea, answering to the work of the Vandals, when they came down and judged the western section of the Roman Empire. And then there was AD 450, the third trumpet. There fell a great star from heaven named Wormwood, and this answered to the judgment of Attila and the Huns in the year AD 450 against the western section of the Roman Empire. And then finally, in the fourth trumpet, we are told that that third part of the sun and the moon and the stars were smitten. That third part being that third section, that western section of the Roman Empire, and it fell. And so that brings us to the year AD 476, the fall of the western section of the Roman Empire. I'm going to come back in a few moments and have a look at a few maps to try and perhaps help explain this to you in a little more detail, because we're going to assume that you don't know anything about history, which may be the safest way of doing this. But while we've got this transparency up, we come over to the other end of it, and we notice now that the fifth and the sixth trumpets are also styled the first woe and the second woe. So there are three woes, the first woe being the fifth trumpet and the fifth trumpet being the first woe, the sixth trumpet being the second woe, and the seventh trumpet being the third woe. And we're going to look principally this evening at this first woe or fifth trumpet. But in case we're assuming a little bit too much when we just start talking glibly about western sections and eastern sections of Roman empires, and because people may lose interest in the real beauty of the apocalypse just because they have to get too involved in history, let's go back and build up our picture from the period, well, at the turn of the period BC AD, if you like. I'm going to project up on the screen now a series of transparencies which are taken from the very readily obtainable book entitled The Penguin Atlas of Medieval History by Colin McAvady. Naturally, it is produced by Penguin Books. These books are available in our library here, and I guess for anybody who's listening on the tape, they can get that book from just about any bookshop, I would imagine, that sells this type of literature. It's a particularly interesting book because it sets out the period of history from about 362 AD through to around about 14 or 1500 in a series of maps with explanations alongside of them. This is an old edition I've got here. The one in the library has a different cover, but the maps are quite identical. And we take up the story from the year AD 362. Now, on this particular map, which incidentally is taken from page 15 of the book that I've just quoted, for anyone who may like to look that up, we're told on the opposite page that the frontiers of the Roman Empire didn't change very much from the time of Augustus through to around about 360, which was the time of Julian the Apostate. You see the heavy black line which encircles the area of the Roman Empire. You may not be able to pick up all the little details of these maps. It doesn't matter. We're only really interested in the heavy black lines to notice the major changes. So this boundary, which we can see on this particular map here, this black line going right around up through England there, across through Europe and down through North Africa, constitutes the boundaries of the Roman Empire. Because of the study this evening, I'll comment on this southern section of the boundary. Notice this boundary here coming around through North Africa and also going down around through Arabia. The Arabian frontier over here and the African frontier over here correspond with the edges of the Arabian and the African deserts. During this period of 350 years, the Arabs were only a nuisance. They never really constituted a danger to the Roman Empire. And so, therefore, for 3.5 centuries, the boundaries of the Roman Empire didn't change, although the internal structure changed quite a bit, as we've seen from our studies. I'm taking now representatives of these various stages. I'm not going through every map in the book or every single event. But the next period we'll take up is the period around about AD 450. We've come on about another 100 years now. So that if you look back at your seven trumpets chart, it'll give you some idea of where we're looking. We're looking right at the period of the third trumpet now, aren't we? So when we come to this period of the third trumpet, remember we were only really interested in the events of this western section of the Roman Empire. But we looked with interest at this particular map now because we noticed that there is a line right down the middle of the Roman Empire. Because of the cord we've got on the wall, we've got more than one line down there, unfortunately, but that's the line we're looking at there. To avoid confusion, if we line it up with that cord, then you don't have to worry about working out which line is which. That's a line which goes right down the middle of the empire. It wasn't just a matter of saying, well, let's divide the empire into two sections. They were virtually now two completely different empires. There was this empire in the west and there was this empire in the east. The empire was divided now into two parts, western and eastern. But in the studies we've been doing on these four trumpets, we were only looking at this section of the Roman Empire over here, that western third of the Roman Empire. We come on a little bit further in period of time. That, incidentally, was a chart from page 21 of the book. The next chart which we're putting up is the map taken from page 23 of the book. And this brings us down to the year AD 476, which we notice from our trumpet chart now corresponds to the fourth trumpet. That's the period at which we left off our last study. And this particular date, AD 476, is generally regarded as the fall of the Western Empire. So we now no longer see in big black letters over here the Western Empire. We have in fact over the area of Italy such terms as the Vandal Kingdom. And we've got other terms around here such as the Visigothic Kingdom and things like that. So with AD 476, the first four trumpets had completed their work. God had now judged that apostate system which was concentrated in the area of Rome. He had done that. But there was still left the influences of Rome over in the east, known as the Eastern Roman Empire. It was quite different. It had its capital in Constantinople, or as it was sometimes called, Byzantium, so that this empire was later called the Byzantine Empire. So we may talk about the Eastern Roman Empire, or we may talk about the Byzantine Empire. So in other words, God had judged through the various tribes that had come down from the north here, the Huns and the Vandals and the Goths and so forth, had judged this section of the Roman Empire, and it was now properly judged. We're now going to turn our attention to the eastern section, and God is going to bring judgments against the eastern section now of the Roman Empire to complete his work against this apostate system. Now these judgments are going to come principally from this quarter down here, from the area of Arabia. And we're going to be looking at a period of history this evening which, if my understanding of history is at all representative of your understanding of history, it's something that you and I didn't know too much about. It's a period dealing with the work of Muhammad, Islam, the Muslims, and so forth. Some of you may know a lot about it. Well, that's good. I now know a lot about it, relatively speaking, to what I used to know anyway. At least enough, I think, to get me through the class. So we're going to look at this evening because it is particularly interesting, and the description which we've got here in Revelation chapter 9 is an extremely accurate, as naturally we would expect, an extremely accurate description of this period of history. Let's just flash one or two maps up, which although they may be premature at this stage, we can always come back to them a little later on to talk about them in more detail. This next map, which is the period of AD 626, is taken from page 35 of that particular booklet, the Penguin Atlas of Medieval History, and it shows us the empire now in the east extending right across into what was originally the Western Empire. So you see, when we talk about the Eastern Empire, it started off in the east, but now with the decline of the west, we're coming on to a period now where, arising out of the work of Justinian in the year 527, who dedicated himself and the Eastern Empire to the reconquest of the west, this empire now, as seen by this heavy black line, now comes right across here into the area of Italy and down into North Africa, and covers much of at least the southern section of what was originally the Western Empire. So you can see now how we're looking at the remnants of the Roman Empire, which were originally now in the east and extending further across into the west. Coming on a little bit further in the period of time, we come to the map on page 37 of the said booklet, and this shows us now how about 25 years later we see a power rising up in the south here, a power which hasn't appeared on any of these maps previously. And whilst this empire, which was previously on the original chart there shown as the Eastern Roman Empire, now called the Byzantine Empire, it's starting to shrink up a little bit, and we've now got a power coming up here from the south known as the Arab Caliphate. I'll define these terms later on, but for the moment, it's a power which constitutes Arabs. And so the Arab power now is starting to move up into this section, and God is going to judge that section of the Roman Empire. And that's what Revelation chapter 9 is going to be about this evening. So around about AD 650, we see the rise of the Caliph. We come on another 100 years approximately, and we find that a new group of Caliphs have come on, just briefly looking at this chart at the moment, and we find that we come to the period of the Umayyads. The Byzantine Empire in the meantime is getting progressively smaller, and the Arabs are extending their power right up around here through North Africa and now into Spain. So the Arab power now is virtually covering, I suppose you could say, two-thirds of what was originally the Roman Empire. They don't touch this area up here in the north. Two-thirds might be a little bit of a broad guess, but you can work it out yourself. You can see the extent answering to the dotted area, which is going right up around through here. And then when we come on our last picture, that one incident was from page 39 if I didn't say it before, and now from page 53 we find another phase of the Arab Empire. You may find that chart rather cluttered. There's a lot of detail on there, but let me just trace it out. There is now what is left of the Byzantine Empire. It wasn't to be completely destroyed. Revelation made it quite clear that they were only going to be tormented. They were going to have a lot of trouble. It wouldn't completely destroy it. The Arabs wouldn't completely destroy it, but they would certainly cause it a lot of trouble and reduce it considerably. And now we come to the Fatimid Caliphate, right around through here, and right up around over the top there through the area of Persia and Assyria and all that sort of area. And so the Eastern Empire then was to be judged as a result of the work which was to be done by some of these Arabs. Now, I think you'll find this interesting if you are prepared to do a little bit of reading. If you ever happen to be shopping around Myers, sorry if those on tape don't happen to have a Myers store where they live, but I noticed this one was out of the Plaza. They had a lot of these going for 45 cents, which is not expensive. A nice little book, about 63 pages in it, called The Rise of Islam. They turn up progressively on the bookstalls out there. There's this one called The Rise of Islam, and there's another interesting one in the series called there was Europe. Europe Patterns of Power, I think it was. No, The Emergence of Europe. Both of those are very relevant to the study of Revelation. And at 45 cents, I don't think anyone could complain about it. It gives a very interesting description of the rise of Islam. The book is called, incidentally, The Rise of Islam. It's the Marshall Cavendish Learning System. This one is called History, and they've got lots of other things on biology and cultural heritage and physical science and things like that. So the Marshall Cavendish Learning System, the book entitled The Rise of Islam. And if you bargain hard, you should be able to get it for about 45 cents, plus or minus a little bit. Now, in this, and I'm going to quote a few sections because I don't think I could describe it any better than what he does here. At dead of night, he says, in commencing his article on page 5, in the summer of 622 AD, soldiers burst into the house of Muhammad. They were sent by the rulers of Mecca to arrest him as an enemy of the people and a danger to the security of the city, trading centre of the Quraysh clansmen of Arabia. Now, the city of Mecca, in case you've never actually seen this on a map, the city of Mecca is down on the Arabian Peninsula. Actually, none of those maps that I put up there earlier on sort of go down far enough. But it's down on the Arabian Peninsula. If you have your notes there on page 97 of your notes, you'll see a map at the bottom of the page, and Mecca is there, and slightly above it is another place called Medina, which will come into this story as well. So in the year 622, there lived a man by the name of Muhammad. This stage, he wasn't terribly important, but he lived there in the city of Mecca. Now, the rulers of the city considered that he was an enemy of the people, and as we've said, a danger to the security of that city. So they invaded his house with the idea of taking him captive. The story goes on to say, pulling Muhammad's relations and servants from their beds, the soldiers thrust torches into their faces, peering from one silhouetted figure to another to find the man who called himself the Prophet of God and who secretly conspired with the enemies of the Quraysh in the rival trading city of Yathrib, now known as Medina. In the confusion, Muhammad, accompanied by Abu Bakr, and that name will come up later on, his disciple and fellow merchant, slipped away into the night, fleeing to the desert hills where they hid in a cave. So Muhammad fled from the city of Mecca, and that becomes a very important event in the establishment of the religion known as Muhammadism, Muslim, Islam, and all sorts of other names which the same thing is called. You'll find Muhammad spelt a dozen different ways. Sometimes it's Muhammad, sometimes Muhammad, sometimes Muhammad, but they're all the same person. You'll hear about Islam, Muslims, Muhammadism, and these things, again, all the same sort of thing. So Muhammad then slips out of the city of Mecca and heads for Medina. By morning, the Quraysh had posted notices putting the price of 100 camels on Muhammad's head, and many of his former neighbours sought to earn the reward. One band of pursuers actually peered into the cave where the fugitives hid without seeing them. Muhammad's supporters made secret trips from Mecca to bring the fugitives food and fast camels. And after several days' journey, they came within sight of Medina, 200 miles to the north. To the people of Medina, Muhammad was no traitor, but the messenger of God. They welcomed him to their city, and he entered in triumph with an escort of 70 soldiers. The flight to Medina, called the Hegira, H-E-G-I-R-A, the breaking of bonds is what the word means, was so important to Muslims, those who submitted to God, that they dated the beginning of their era from that event. So the Muslim calendar dates from what is known as the Hegira, the flight from Mecca to Medina. And that's where it all started. During the next 10 years, most of the Medinians adopted the new faith, but Muhammad's success brought him little peace. Practically the whole of this period was spent in bitter, merciless warfare, often against the Quraysh. The character of intertribal warfare in Arabia at that time may be judged from a passage in the Quran, the holy book which Muslims claim to be the words of God, revealed to Muhammad and committed to writing after his death. And those words are these: the messenger of God may take no captive until there has been slaughter in the land. An example of this philosophy in practice occurred when Muhammad was faced with the problem of what to do with the Bani Qurayza, a Jewish tribe allied to the Muslims, who were discovered to be secretly negotiating with these other people, the Quraysh. When they'd been taken prisoner, Muhammad, undecided what to do with them, passed the task of judgment to the chief of another allied Jewish tribe, a man who, under stress of wounds in battle, had become a fanatical Muslim. The chief decreed, "I condemn the men to death, their property should be divided among the victors, their women and children should become slaves." On the following morning, the sentence was carried out exactly as decreed. Thus, the early days of Islam were bathed in blood. Now, that's quite an unbiased historical source. It's not a Christadelphian book which is trying to colour it up to make it fit Revelation chapter 9. That's it. One final small extract, and we could, of course, read a lot more. By 632, that was 10 years from the flight from Mecca to Medina, by 632, when Muhammad died, most of Arabia had fallen to Islam. At his death, the gentle, faithful, and prematurely old Abu Bakr was appointed caliph. Now, we came across that word caliph before, and the word caliph simply means successor. So you see, there's a few words there that we've heard which we must understand the meaning of. The word Hegira is the flight. It means the breaking of bonds. The word Muslim is one who submits to God. And the word caliph simply means successor. So whilst Muhammad started it all off, he was followed on by Abu Bakr, who was to be his successor, or the first in a line of caliphs. And so there were the different caliphates, the Umayyad caliphates and the Abbasid caliphates and so forth and so on. Unaffected in character by his elevation to what was virtually a kingship, Abu Bakr continued to sell his cloth in the marketplace. Meanwhile, his commanders, with his blessing, embarked on a jihad, J-I-H-A-D, which was a holy war against Syria, then a province of the Byzantine Empire. And even today, of course, the Arabs are talking about their holy wars, and they are frequently conducting jihads against Israel. And it all started here with Muhammad. And so, in a terrific burst of energy, the Muslim armies cut clean through the enfeebled Byzantine and Persian empires. And then it goes on to speak about what the various successors of that crowd did. So that's a little bit about how Islam all started. Now let's go to the Bible, because that's going to tell us exactly the same thing, but it's going to be looking at it through God's eyes, and it's going to be showing to us how this fits in to this overall theme of God manifestation. What's happened is that there has been set up a power in the world which we know as the Roman Empire. It's an apostate power. It was at one stage a pagan power. At another time it became a power centred in Byzantium. Another phase of it was the Holy Roman Empire. Another phase of it was the Papal Roman Empire. But whatever it is, it was Roman and it was to be judged. So the first four trumpets deal with God's judgment on that western section. Now we're going to have a look at how he's going to raise up men like Muhammad, Abu Bakr, and the various caliphs to pour out his judgment in the terms of two trumpets, the fifth trumpet and the sixth trumpet, to bring about his judgment on that section of this apostate system. So if we open at Revelation 9 and our notes at page 97, we'll integrate the two of these. And what I'm also going to do tonight, because I've been talking to some of you about Bible marking on Revelation, and you say, well, how do you manage to put those notes into your Bible? Well, I don't put those notes into the Bible. I think the notes we've got here are a little bit sort of more narrative type of thing, but I'll put up a few transparencies this evening which are summaries of what each of these verses talks about, and if you care to copy them down and use it as the basis of Bible marking, well, that's up to you, but it may be a little bit of a help to some who want to help in that direction. You probably think the notes are fairly brief, but then again, once you've got the general story, well, you probably only need brief notes anyway. On page 97, we've got our introduction, which we might just as well read, just to make sure we don't leave anything out. At the close of the series of judgments represented by the first four trumpets, and culminating in the extinction of the Roman Empire in the west, we enter upon another phase of events affecting more particularly the eastern section of the empire, though also bearing vitally upon all parts of the civilized world. You can understand that, can't you, because that transparency we saw answering to the period of around about, what was it, 626, showed to us that whilst it was called the Eastern Empire, it went right across to Spain. So the word Eastern might have applied in the first instance, but it certainly spread its tentacles much further afield. So as we've said, it affects other parts of the civilized world as well. It is a phase so well marked in history as to constitute an epoch and the starting point of a new order of things in many countries. The Roman world was about to be visited by a scourge far transcending the inroads of the northern barbarians, who at least professed the same religion and assimilated with the populations of the countries they overthrew. Because of the appalling nature of this visitation, attention was called in a special manner to the trumpets heralding its approach. And that's why this one is going to be a woe. You see, we did discuss, didn't we, when we were looking at the fall of the Western Empire, that the tribes out of Europe came down and they sort of assimilated Rome. So that Europe today is really the breakdown of the Roman Empire of old. But the Arabs had nothing in common with these people at all, completely and absolutely foreign to them. And that's why there has to be a different series of judgments. So we come then to our exposition of Revelation chapter 9. Verse 1 of the chapter introduces us to this man Muhammad, although of course it doesn't mention him by name. I'm not really trying to hide it from you, it's only just so we can direct our attention to one part of the time without going too far, too fast. Now, first of all, we are introduced in chapter 9, verse 1, to a star. The fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth. Now, I think on occasions we've assumed that when we come to stars and suns and moons and grass, that everybody just takes my word for it that a star represents a prominent man. I thought tonight we might just consolidate some of this by looking at one or two references where necessary, just to confirm really that these things mean what we claim they mean. Our note tells us on the transparency that a star represents a prominent person in the political realm. I think we are familiar by this stage that the term heaven is frequently used of political realm, political heaven, political power if you like. So therefore a star is a prominent figure in the political realm. And we've got two references there. While you're copying them down, I'll look them up. Isaiah 13, verse 10, and Isaiah chapter 14, verses 12 and 13. Both of these make references to the stars in a symbolic sense as having application to prominent people. The one in Isaiah chapter 13 and verse 10, speaking about the judgments that God was going to bring on Babylon, says, "For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in his going forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine." Now this is in a section which we're told is the burden of Babylon, and it was a judgment which was to come upon the power of Babylon. And as far as that power was concerned, the stars of the heaven and the constellations thereof would not give their light. Now, taking that theme up as that parable continues into chapter 14, we find in chapter 14, verse 12, "How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, or day star, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground which did weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of Ael. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north." Well, there's a couple of references. You get your concordance out like I did, and you can find others too which will support this idea. So then, in Revelation chapter 9 and verse 1, we've got a star falling from heaven. Now, the star, as we've said, would be a prominent man in whatever heaven it is that he's going to fall out of. But he's not in the heaven now because he's fallen from it. Now, this prominent man, who was not a king, later on in the chapter you read about an angel out of the pit who was a king. This man wasn't a king. He was a prophet. He was the prophet Muhammad. And we're told, therefore, in chapter 9 and verse 1, that he fell from heaven. Now, note on the transparency says, that is, it was to represent the downfall of this person. It answers in historical terms to the Hegira, or the flight of Muhammad from Mecca to Medina in the year 622. And this was the beginning of the Muhammadan era, and is so represented in this particular passage. So the star falling from heaven is this prominent man who was quite prominent in the city of Mecca, not as a king, but as a prophet. The rulers of the city thought that he was going to be an embarrassment to them as far as their trade was concerned, and so they came, as we read a little earlier on, to take him captive, but he got out of it. He fled. He fell from heaven. And he went to Medina, where he set up his system of religion. Whilst he didn't actually conquer the world, he laid the basis for those that followed him, his successors, or the caliphs, to go out and do just what he really, in fact, laid the basis for, and encouraged them to do through the words of the Quran. So he fell from heaven. Well, where did he fall to? Well, naturally, he fell unto the earth. But all these terms are very important in the book of Revelation. And when we say that he fell unto the earth, we must define the earth. It was the Roman earth. It was the mission of Muhammad to torment the unsealed idolaters of the Eastern Roman Empire. I've used the term the unsealed. I do that because a little later on, we're going to come across this term, those who were not sealed. And so I don't want to explain every term at this stage, not until it's absolutely relevant. So we've got the star, it falls from heaven, it falls unto the earth. Now we're told that there was given to him the key. What is a key? Well, Muhammad was given a key or power to establish a royal dynasty out of the undistinguished multitude of Arabs. Our notes tell us. And the transparency tells us something similar to that, that a key is power to establish a royal dynasty. We've got two references there. We've come across them both before. One of them is Isaiah chapter 22 verse 22, and the other reference is Revelation 3 verse 7, which is related to the one in Isaiah. It speaks about the key of the house of David. And the key of the house of David, which was laid upon the shoulders of Eliakim in Revelation 22, and laid upon the shoulders of the Lord Jesus Christ, of course, in the antitypical sense. So a key is power. Don't know where to stand, I'm sorry. I'll just keep moving that thing forward, so take the intentional pattern. A key then is power, and power to establish a royal dynasty. Although the kingdom of heaven is the world dynasty. Yes, I was conscious of that when I put the note down, as a matter of fact. In this particular case, it's power to establish the world dynasty. Peter was given the keys to the kingdom of heaven. You could say, in a sense, that was a world dynasty as well, but the emphatic word is power there. It's the ability to unlock something and enter in, whether you're going literally into a place or whether you're going into a place of power. And so what he was given a key to unlock was the bottomless pit. And that's what enabled us to understand it as being a royal dynasty. He was going to have power over this particular area. Now, we've covered a lot of points here fairly quickly. Don't worry, we'll go back over them in just a moment. And what he was going to have power over or into, if you like, was what is styled in chapter 9 and verse 1, the bottomless pit. I've noted here that the phrase bottomless pit should better be rendered as the pit of the abyss, as it is in the Revised Version. The word bottomless is the Greek word abyssos. B-Y-S-S-O-S means bottom, and if you put an A in front of it, that makes it negative, so it means without a bottom. That means it's bottomless. So I suppose bottomless isn't a bad word, really, but it's not altogether used in the physical sense, the literal sense that that something just goes on and on and on. You'll find the word bottomless used in other places in the New Testament, speaking of like a deep sea. The Sea of Galilee was very deep at a certain point, and things like this. So it's an abyss, it's a very, very deep place, figuratively speaking, so deep that it's almost bottomless. So it's the pit of the abyss that he's got the key to. So we've got a star then, a prominent man, falls from the heaven in which he was, a position of prominence, and he falls unto the earth. He's cast out of Mecca, flees to Medina, and the effect that he's going to have, and the caliph that followed him, is to bring judgment upon the Roman earth. In order for this to be achieved, he's given a key to the pit of the abyss, which we have defined as being the area of Arabia. Now let's go back and try and tie all this up together in the terms of some of our notes. I think the best thing to do at this stage is just to quickly go through our notes on page 98, which are only really going to repeat what I've said, but I don't think you'll object to me repeating it, and then we'll have a look at our historical notes. So we'll just take the note on page 98, and then it'll just about be time for us to turn our tapes over, and then we'll have a look at the next section. Page 98 tells us that the star represents one who had acquired power and become a king. It refers to Muhammad, who commenced